If you eat out, you don't want a side of anxiety. I'm John Raby, sitting in for A. Martinez today. And on Take Two, we're going to talk with one of the owners of what was one of L.A.'s most popular restaurants, Hippo in Highland Park, about the difficulties of not only keeping staff and patrons safe, but creating a space where people will feel safe eating out. Plus, Orange County with Nick Gerda. It's all on the way after the news. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm John Raby in for A. Martinez. Today I am wearing a superhero's t-shirt for A. Hey, A, hope you're enjoying your vacation. Thanks for joining us today, everybody. Coming up.
Space is still there and space is still doing its thing and producing some absolutely gorgeous things for all of us to take a look at.
Times are tough, but if you look up at the night sky, you can still find some inspiration. That's ahead a little bit later on today's show. But first, Governor Gavin Newsom says it's not up to him to determine when California gets back to normal. It's on all of us.
It's our decisions that will determine how quickly our children go back to school. It is our decisions that will determine what kind of activities we get to once again enjoy with our friends and family. And of course, it's our decisions, personal and sum total of all of our decisions, that will determine how quickly our business sector can reopen with some semblance of the way things used to be.
Governor Newsom also announced this afternoon that California salons and barbershops that were closed under the state's public health orders can now provide their services outside, so you can get a trim and a tan. COVID-19-related closures have affected nearly every aspect of life here in Southern California, like eating al fresco, as I learned yesterday.
This is Take Two. I'm John Raby, sitting in for A. Martinez today. You can still eat out in L.A. during the pandemic, but most of us don't want dinner served with a side of anxiety. Which brings me to the patio of the restaurant Hippo in Highland Park, part of the Silver Lake Wine Empire, who are, by the way, longtime supporters of KPCC. David Rossoff is the co-owner and GM of Hippo. Hi, David.
Hi, John. How are you?
So that listeners don't freak out, we are 6 feet away. We're using a 10-foot mic cord. You've sterilized your own microphone and mic cord.
This is correct. Yes, I have. Just don't lean in, John.
Okay, I'll stay right here. I want to talk about the anxiety that many of us are feeling trying to dine out. But first, I want to back up, if we could. Take us back to mid-March or whenever it was that you guys were starting to think about COVID-19 and how it might affect your business. When did you first have inklings that this might affect the way you do business?
It was palpable by the start of March that things were shifting in an onerous direction, and we saw on the horizon the potential that business would be affected, even if there wasn't a shutdown, that people were going to be concerned about dining out. Mm-hmm. So we were not thinking about reopening and what to do with our patio and our parking lot. We were just thinking about how to transition into takeout and delivery.
Then when did you start thinking about doing alfresco dining?
Once we heard that it was going to be allowed, we started thinking about it. And shortly after that was when things changed in the city and the country on a totally different level, and one that we frankly wanted to allow our staff to participate in. To get everything into place in the way that we have takes a little bit of time to do the research, CDC and health department protocols.
That's like a 5-page protocol.
It's 11 pages, to be exact.
Roughly, so our listeners can hear it. You're also doing the normal protocols, like everybody's got to be masked. You have hand sanitizer on every table. If you get up from your table, you've got to wear a mask. All the servers, if I remember correctly from dinner a couple nights ago, are masked and with a face shield?
Masked and shielded, yes.
Yep.
Everybody is, not just the servers. Anybody who's working for us in the front of the house is masked and shield at all times.
My husband and I have tried several alfresco restaurants. I'm not going to name the ones that didn't work out, but one is a place that has a small patio, and what wound up happening is that a lot of their bar patrons, instead of hanging out in the bar, came and hung out in the patio, and the more they drank, the less respectful they were of the protocols. And then another place is in Glendale. It's a big place that has a pretty big patio on the sidewalk now, serving Mediterranean food. The staff were really, really careful about the protocols, except I think the tables were a little close.
Mm-hmm.
But the patrons, while they arrived masked, would as soon as they got to their tables, stopped taking any sort of protocol. So clearly people from outside their families would come up to the table and join them, and they'd be hugging and stuff. And there were also some big tables when we got there filled with people who I don't think were all in the same family. So while I didn't feel especially, and my husband felt the same way, we didn't feel like our health was an imminent threat. We just felt anxiety the whole time because we're witnessing this behavior that we think is irresponsible, and it just drove us nuts. It made us mad. It made us ticked off, and it just like we didn't want to see it. So even though the food was delicious, even though the servers were really nice and all that, and it was cool being outside, it just was like having dinner with a huge side of anxiety.
Sure, sure. Yeah, we do not offer that on the menu. The side of anxiety is not part of our protocols. And occasionally you do see somebody walk in, mask hanging down or no mask or not distancing. And everybody on the staff is empowered to address that person. And if they do not want to play along, then this is just not the right campus for them.
How many people have refused to wear the mask or have...
Zero.
Zero, really?
Yeah. Well, there have been people that have come in without a mask that we have given a mask to, very few, but there hasn't been anybody that we have had to remove from the premises.
Oh, I think that's probably not the case at a lot of restaurants.
I guess it says something for our clientele, but I feel like the biggest challenge we have had, and I hate to say this because we're doing a very brisk delivery business, has been with the delivery drivers. That presents a greater challenge than any of our guests have. This industry is still relatively new and has exploded, obviously, overnight, where the demand for drivers for all of these platforms is astronomical.
Oh, and the drivers are not your employees.
Oh, no. So it's a third party.
Right.
And we use two different platforms, and I don't want to name them, but they mostly do a great job. But they're hiring a lot of people, and they cannot require them to follow any protocols. They can only request that of them.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a problem.
It is a problem. But then we monitor ourselves. So if we see a driver come in without a mask or somebody repeatedly coming in with a mask that's hanging down, we'll contact the platform and let them know that that person can't deliver for us.
If restaurants don't follow the rules, aren't you afraid that you're going to get shut down? Like one kid in a class on the field trip misbehaves, everybody has to go home.
Yes.
Some restaurant is going to screw it up for everybody?
Absolutely. It's maddening, infuriating, disrespectful. I have been to some places myself that were not following the protocols. It's a direct affront to any operators, to the staff in any restaurants, when you see that kind of behavior, because that's why we are where we are. That's why we're moving backwards. That's why I'm in a mask and a shield every night on the floor of the restaurant, which I assure you is not comfortable, and it's very, very hard to communicate with guests like that.
Right, it's all... Woo.
Yeah.
So how afraid are you that you'll be shut down just because restaurants can't behave?
I think
on
it's
the
in the back of our minds all the time.
Yeah.
And I don't think that any, like going to level red and the county shutting down again would be strictly about restaurants, but that is a great example, a very easy example to cite of people not complying, both guests and operators.
Yeah.
I would love to see the health department with an inspector in every restaurant every day. I would like to be inspected on a regular basis because then I would know others are being inspected too.
Yeah. You've got guests here, I'm sure, on any given night who are only following the protocol when they're here, and they might be like groups of friends that get together who shouldn't be getting together. What do you do about that?
It is true that we can't trace that, and we have, or the health department has required us to seat no more than six people. So we're not having mass gatherings. And from what I have observed, most of the reservations are parties of two.
Are you guys making enough money now doing the patio service that you can stay in business indefinitely? Or does this have a window?
This is not a great long-term business model. And so I think all of us in the industry are in a survival mode right now, and we're trying to figure out a way to stay open, to stay alive. And that is job number one, keeping our staff employed and keeping the doors open. I don't think any of my partners are expecting a return on the investment right now. That said, we have a revenue stream in takeout and delivery we never had before. And now, every night, even with the dining room or the parking lot open, we have a steady flow of people picking up food and deliveries going out.
Thank you for talking with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We're in Highland Park in the patio of Hippo, talking with David Rossoff, who's co-owner and GM of Hippo. This is Take Two. I'm John Raby.
The childcare workforce is mostly made up of women of color who are not paid very much. After decades of fighting, they could, though, be on the verge of approving union representation to help get themselves higher wages. As KPCC's Mariana Dale reports, the system they're trying to change is rooted in inequality.
When I reach family care provider Sue Carrera by Zoom, she's sitting in her classroom.
Well, I'll just show you around.
Most of her Inglewood home is dedicated to the kids she cares for. The walls are painted a soft green that Carrera says helps keep the kids calm. In the living room, there's a custom-built wooden playhouse.
That's the one that the infants use, and it helps them to learn to crawl upstairs and slide and walk and all kinds of stuff.
Carrera says her business is always at full capacity with 14 kids ages 7 and under.
I'm able to pay my bills, but, you know, to say, do you have money left over at the end of the month for yourself? The answer is usually no.
Many of the families Carrera works with receive childcare through one of California's subsidy programs for low-income parents. And she's one of at least 43,000 providers in the state who count on these payments. The system of publicly funded early childhood programs was flawed from its inception. 40 years ago, an LA Times article described a confusing, complex childcare system that didn't pay providers enough and ignored families in need.
This absolutely could have been written today. Unfortunately, it's not surprising.
Leah Austin leads the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment at the University of California, Berkeley. The average pay for childcare workers nationally is a little more than $10 an hour. Austin says African-American and Latino early educators are most likely to be in the lowest paying jobs.
There is a long history in this country of people expecting servitude and Black women and brown women to care for other people and other people's children without having the means to care for themselves and their own children.
And these ideas didn't just come out of thin air.
That's Verna Williams, dean at the University of Cincinnati College of Law. She says in the early 20th century, training programs available to Black women often focused on domestic work, including childcare.
You know, harkening back to their days in slavery, where enslaved women took care of their owners' children.
We now know that critical brain development happens in the first few years of life, but today's early educators have inherited a system that doesn't value their work and ultimately shortchanges children. Williams says the inequalities are baked in.
I hope that with this pandemic and the need for quality childcare becoming so evident, that is an impetus for some change.
California's lawmakers are trying to improve publicly funded childcare. Right now, the state relies on outdated data to determine how much providers get back from the state for their work. Assemblymember Kevin McCarty sponsored legislation that would overhaul the whole payment system.
Essentially, it's a shame on us for not stepping up to our values and paying the proper rate to make these programs viable for providers and for families.
Last fall, home providers won collective bargaining rights under another bill signed by Governor Gavin Newsom. Child Care Providers United is currently conducting an election to represent the child care workers. And in South L.A., Wendy Moran wants union representation. She wakes up at 3:45 a.m. to open her home daycare and, with the help from three assistants, runs it 24 hours a day, both because the families need it and because financially it's the only way to make it work.
Stress, but I know how to manage the stress. I enjoy what I do, but it was my sleep that is really hurting me.
A few years ago, she started getting migraines. Her doctor said she needed more sleep. She thought about cutting her hours, but her clients couldn't find other options.
It's hard for me to say no. I can still find a way to take a nap over the day and figure out how to help.
Moran and other providers will find out if they'll have a union to fight for them when the election votes are tallied Friday. Covering early childhood, I'm Mariana Dale.
Hey, everybody, we're going to get right back to Take Two. I'm John Raby sitting in today for A. Martinez. It's a real pleasure to be back in the radio station. I had been working remotely, so I'm seeing people I haven't seen in a long time. Turns out I miss them. I like them. I hope they feel the same. We'll find out. Anyway, coming up as Take Two continues our weekly chat with the Sage of Orange County. Plus, camping and backpacking are good for you, and they're also low risk for COVID, but not no risk. There are some rules you need to follow to be safe. We will get a report in just a few minutes. You're back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Raby in for A. Martinez. Voice of OC reporter Nick Gerda joins us most Mondays to catch us up on Orange County, where health officials are struggling to provide enough coronavirus testing and contact tracing to contain the spread. Nick's back today. Hi, Nick. Great to meet you.
Hey, great to meet you, too. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. We're going to talk about coronavirus in just a second, but first, kind of breaking news. News just came out about the legal malpractice in the case against Scott DeCry, the man charged with killing eight people in the Seal Beach massacre in 2011. Can you give us the latest on that?
Yeah, so this centers on that 2011 mass shooting, which was the largest mass killing in Orange County history. Back in that case, the entire DA's office was kicked off the case for mishandling informants and withholding evidence about it from the defense and from the court itself. The judge was not too happy about that. And today, the new DA, who's been in office for about a year and a half, Todd Spitzer, released an internal investigation report that found prosecutors in the prior administration that handled this case had engaged in an intentional misconduct, according to the findings of that report, by violating defendants' constitutional rights. These are all allegations in this new report by the DA. The appeals court had already concluded this a couple years ago, that there was misconduct by the prosecutors. They used language more like whether it was intentional or negligent, but certainly it was on the prosecutor's responsibility to make sure that evidence was disclosed and that they weren't misusing informants. Now, this is the first time the DA's office itself is saying that there was, or claiming there was, intentional misconduct.
So this is kind of getting on the record.
Exactly, getting it on the record and certainly causing more discussion about what went down here and who's being held responsible.
All right, let's move on to coronavirus. Every week, it seems like cases are surging in Orange County. What are the latest numbers?
So Orange County has seen some encouraging signs in the last few days. Hospitalizations are down, currently about 666 people hospitalized with COVID in Orange County, down from a high of about 720 last week. Part of what's going on is some of these patients are being moved to an emergency hospital at Fairview Developmental Center, but county officials say that they are encouraged to see this decline. At the same time, though, they're having a hard time containing outbreaks that are popping up. There's a shortage of testing and contact tracing. There's a high positivity rate with the testing, which points to a shortage and potential delays of a week or more in getting tested for people. Meanwhile, the White House Task Force on Coronavirus has put Orange County in what it calls the red zone for new cases, showing that there is a surge in the eyes of the White House Task Force, and they're giving strong recommendations for people to physically distance and wear face coverings in these counties.
What's the county doing to deal with the limited resources then?
Yeah, so they've said that they've been ramping up some testing. They set up a new testing site in Anaheim that adds about 10% to the county's testing capacity. And they're saying they're trying to do the best that they can with the limited resources they have and really focusing those on trying to contain outbreaks at places like nursing homes.
Specific outbreaks, let's talk about those just for a second. Last week, Newsom closed indoor dining across the state. Is it too early to say whether that's lowered infections among restaurant workers in the OC?
Yeah, so the county is pointing to a very strong correlation that they're not 100% of on whether it caused a decrease, but they're saying there's very strong numbers showing that when indoor dining opened up back in May, there was a sharp rise in outbreaks reported at restaurants in Orange County. And now that indoor dining has been closed by the governor starting early this month, they've seen a noticeable decline in the number of outbreaks that are reported. So that's, you know, they're pointing to that as a potential sign that these health orders and effects are really making a difference.
But OC is also taking a different approach than other counties when it comes to publicizing outbreaks, like publicizing the outbreaks at restaurants or businesses.
Exactly. So in LA County, there's a list online from the county health department that shows a full list of businesses and workplaces that have had outbreaks, how many staff have tested positive, how many staff have symptoms and are awaiting results. And it really goes to show the kinds of places that are more at risk, like meatpacking plants, apparel manufacturers, and even individual police stations and sheriff stations. Orange County's not doing that. They're saying they will not post that kind of data because they're worried that it will reduce cooperation with businesses when there are outbreaks and that they don't see it as fair to the businesses. I asked LA County about that, and LA County says that they have not seen any problems with cooperation. But Orange County's holding firm to not releasing the specific outbreak information.
If listeners want some of the specific numbers, Orange County released today that one more person has died of coronavirus, raising the OC's death toll to 493. They're also reporting 560 new cases, raising the total to just shy of 30,000. By the way, in LA County, 9 more deaths. Switch gears now to schools. We talked last week about how the Orange County Board of Education wanted to open schools for in-person classes this fall. That plan has since been squashed by Newsom. Is there any chance the County Board of Education can still have its way on that?
At this point, no. The board does not have any actual power to mandate school districts open. It's ultimately up to each school district. So they had issued these recommendations, kind of encouraging schools to reopen without masks or social distancing in place. Most of the larger districts in Orange County had actually announced last week that they were not going to follow those recommendations from the County Board of Education and were going to have either online-only classes or have social distancing and masking in place, particularly for the older children in schools. So it was a mixture of responses from the different districts. But now on Friday, with Newsom's announcement that schools will be all online-only so long as the county is on the watch list, which Orange County and pretty much every major county in California is. That's all on hold, and we'll have to wait and see if the counties reduce the number of cases they're reporting day by day, hospitalizations going down. All of those metrics will come into play for whether schools will be allowed to reopen. But yeah, for now, the understanding is that schools will not be open so long as the county is on, open in person, I should say, so long as the county is on this watch list.
I'm talking with Nick Gerda, reporter with The Voice of OC. Finally, let's talk about housing, looking specifically at eviction moratoriums in Santa Ana. Protections are going to end for renters in that city. What are you hearing?
Yeah, my colleague Brandon Foe has a story on this today. For the past few months, a lot of low-income renters in Santa Ana have been soothing their anxiety during the pandemic as they lose jobs and income with the reassurance that they would not be evicted under a citywide renter protection. That's set to end next Tuesday. But there's already some signs from tenants that have spoken with my colleague Brandon that said that landlords are already ramping up pressure on them and harassment to get them out as the deadline approaches. And activists are concerned about a wave of eviction notices on the horizon if the city council doesn't take action to extend those protections. And we'll have to see how this all plays out.
Yeah, and something big breaks. We'll be talking with you about it next week. Thanks, Nick Gerda, reporter with The Voice of OC.
Thanks, John.
Take two. I'm John Raby in for A. I'm Jay, in for A. It's summertime and a pandemic, but the nice thing is you can still enjoy the outdoors as long as you remain physically distanced and wear that mask and don't think about the pandemic too much. Some outdoor activities that are considered pretty low risk are camping and backpacking, right? But even then, you got to be responsible as the threat of COVID-19 grows. From Sacramento, Capital Public Radio's Ezra David Romero looked into it.
Fed up with working from home, my colleague Emily Zentner and I went on a backpacking trip 4th of July weekend.
My buddies and I named that mountain over there Mount Doom. Oh. And on the entire hike, you can see it.
Mount Doom is actually a range called the Sierra Buttes. We started at Grouse Ridge in the Tahoe National Forest and hiked past a dozen lakes to our final destination, Penner Lake. It was about 4 miles.
The sunset is beautiful.
See, these are the lakes we're going to go to.
Along the way, we kept hearing an owl.
Do it again, owl.
The wilderness was packed, partly because it was the 4th of July weekend, but also because people are tired of being indoors. But how safe is it to backpack or camp during a pandemic?
If you're hiking with people who you aren't in a household with, and you're close enough that you can easily talk with each other quietly, then you probably are close enough that you can be spreading droplets.
Miranda Worthen is an epidemiologist. She studies the intersection of health and recreation at San Jose State. When going outdoors, it's good to weigh how much risk you're willing to take. She says to go outdoors only with people you've mutually chosen to share risk with. That still means staying at least 6 feet away from each other and having a mask handy.
You're only as risk-free as the least cautious person in that bubble.
When people camp or backpack, they usually have to drive a distance to a trailhead. Allison Wright with REI suggests gassing up in your own community and packing your own meals instead of stopping along the way.
It's just out of my comfort. I can pack my own lunch. Small changes in our behavior can help us lower our risk.
This is about protecting the communities you enter. She also says to reevaluate the type of outdoor activity you're contemplating this year.
You know, instead of hiking a strenuous hike or instead of going on a 5-10 route rock climbing, that you take a more moderate approach.
One more thing. She says to have options in mind. For example, if your first hike looks packed, go to your second or third option. Also, have a map or download an app like All Trails on your phone. Worthen, the epidemiologist from San Jose State, says it's just not that smart to be around a lot of people during the pandemic.
If you're kind of all clustered around the campfire at night and there's not much of a wind and you're laughing and singing camp songs and you're sitting there for 2 hours, that's a risky behavior.
But she also points out that being in nature is restorative, although there is no real safe recreation.
We have to make trade-offs. And I fully support people doing safer recreation, especially if you or people in your household are feeling a lot of distress.
Back in the Tahoe National Forest, Emily Zentner and I are climbing back up the ridge.
Woo! Did it.
You did do it.
Made it to the top. And you can see where we went, too. That's the lake we camped at.
For me, the trip was definitely what I needed to de-stress from all the news and the worries in the world right now. In Sacramento, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Hey everybody, John Raby in for A. Martinez today. You know, when they were hiking, if they were hiking at the right time, they could have seen the comet NEOWISE, because when you're out in nature is like one of the best times to see it, right? I would love it if you would go to your phone right now and download. I'm not recommending this app, like I'm not endorsing this app, but I have been using for a number of years the Go Sky Watch app. It's free, there aren't any ads in it, and it's a really great way to look at the night sky. I'm holding it up right now and looking at what might be the night sky if it were dark out and I were outside. And you can type in NEOWISE comet, and it will point you to that comet. So before we start our next segment, which is coming up in a few minutes, talking with one of the people who helped discover the comet, why not download that, the Go Sky Watch app. So coming up, riding the time machine that is the comet, when Take 2 continues here on KPCC.
Starry, starry night. Paint your palette blue and gray. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul. Shadows on the hills. Sketch the trees and the daffodils. Catch the breeze and the winter chills in colors on the snowy linen land. Now I understand what you tried to say to me, how you suffered for your sanity, and how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they did not know how. Perhaps they'll listen now.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm John Raby, sitting in today for A. Martinez. When this old world starts getting me down and people are just too much for me to face, I climb way up to the top of the stairs and let my thoughts drift off into space. And nowadays, I'm looking at a brand new comet called NEOWISE, and I'm on the line now with Emily Kramer. She's a researcher at JPL and part of the team that discovered NEOWISE. Emily, thanks for discovering the comet.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Yeah, it's great. Now, first of all, let's talk about NEOWISE. Why is it called NEOWISE?
So NEOWISE is the name of the spacecraft that we use to observe the comet. Traditionally, comets have been named after the person who discovered them, usually whoever was looking through the telescope that night. With modern surveys, we have a large team who's looking through the data. And so what we do is rename it after the telescope or observatory that discovers it, so that way everyone can share kind of the glory of discovering a comet.
So what is Comet NEOWISE?
So Comet NEOWISE is, we like to call them icy mud balls. So they're these collection of ice and dust that are careening through space. So when astronomers say ice, they don't just mean water ice. They also mean mix of carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and a few other trace elements as well.
And the dust, what's that made of?
So the dust is very early material from the early solar system. So it's bits of carbon and silicates and things like that that haven't changed much since the comet formed way back 4.5 billion years ago.
Wow, so the comet is a time machine.
That's exactly right, yeah. We like to think of these comets as ways to look back into what our solar system was like when it was first formed. A lot of the planets in our inner solar system and the asteroids have been heated a fair bit since their initial formation, so their composition has changed substantially. Whereas the comets, because they've been so far away from the sun for the most part, have been in cold storage since that time.
How was it discovered?
So we use the NEOWISE spacecraft to scan the skies for these new asteroids and comets. Basically, what we do is we take a picture of the sky, and then we take another picture of the same area of the sky a short time later and see what has changed between those two images. If something has moved, that's usually an indication that it's an asteroid or a comet. We'll then follow that up with more observations by other telescopes around the world to get a confirmation of the object's orbit and if it's cometary in nature, like we have seen with this comet NEOWISE.
Is part of the reason you're doing this to track asteroids that might hit Earth?
Yeah, so one of the goals of the NEOWISE mission is to detect and characterize these near-Earth objects. We're part of the NASA's Planetary Defense Coordination Office.
NEOWISE, N-E-O, WISE.
Yes, so that is exactly right.
Near-Earth object, I got it, finally.
Yep.
So that's right. So that's part what you and you discovered this in the course of that. Well, I climbed up on top of my roof with my husband the other night, and we found it. It took a lot of work, and since we live in Cypress Park, there was a lot of light pollution, and it was pretty hard to find. But you have a different story to tell.
That's right. So I've seen it pretty faintly from the Pasadena-Glendale area a couple times, but I decided this weekend to make the drive up to the Death Valley area, to the mountains near that area, and was able to get an absolutely just phenomenal view of the comet. Wow. The sky was some of the darkest I've seen in years. The Milky Way was so bright it practically glowed. And the comet was easily visible with the naked eye, and just the tail was so long, the width of several fingers across the sky. It was amazing.
Wow. Yeah, when we saw it, it just looked like a little snowball up above a couple of stars. For our listeners, no matter where they live, how do they find it and look at it?
The best way to find it is to go outside just a little bit after sunset, and when the stars start to come out, find the Big Dipper. And once you find the Big Dipper, look around about two fists below the Big Dipper or so, and that's going to be in the northwest part of the sky. The comet will be around that area. It moves a little bit every day relative to the background stars, so you may have to look in a slightly different location depending on when exactly you go look. And the best thing to do is, if you do have binoculars, try to scan the sky around that area, and that will help you find it. It's much easier to spot without binoculars once you've seen it with binoculars. But then again, it's not absolutely necessary to use the binoculars. And especially if you're in a darker area with fewer lights, it's easier to see it.
How fast is this thing moving?
It's moving very fast. So these comets, their speed varies throughout their orbit. When they're far away from the sun, they're moving pretty slow. And when they're in the inner solar system, they're moving very fast. So as of right now, this comet's moving about twice as fast as the Earth is around the sun. So if you can imagine, if it happened to be in the same orbit as the Earth, it'd be going twice as fast around. So it is zooming along very fast.
And what's our window of opportunity here?
So it's really better to see it sooner rather than later. Comets are notoriously difficult to predict about how bright they're going to be. This comet, we had an idea that it might be pretty bright, and it's been staying pretty good. I would say sooner rather than later is the best thing to do. We expect it'll stay naked eye bright for the next maybe week or two, hopefully more. It's hard to really say for sure.
And then after that, when's it coming back?
Oh, it'll be a good long while. This comet has an orbit of about 6,800 years. So I would say this is your best opportunity to see the object within the next week.
You know, I started this segment using the lyrics from Up on the Roof. But I really do kind of feel that, especially today when things are so incredibly hectic and confusing and scary, that it's really good to build in some things that get you out of your head.
Yeah, I agree. I really do think that looking up this night sky can really help to give folks some perspective on how big the universe really is and all of the exciting things that are out there. There are a lot of challenges in the world today. But space is still there, and space is still doing its thing and producing some absolutely gorgeous things for all of us to take a look at.
Emily Kramer is a researcher at JPL and part of the team that discovered the comet NEOWISE. Thanks for taking the time, Emily.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
In just a few minutes, as Take Two continues, it's time for our weekly conversation with John Horn, and I've got so many questions to ask him about his new podcast, Hollywood the Sequel. Like, what's up with Tenet? How could Hollywood still not get it when it comes to inclusion? And where did you interview the late, great John Lewis? The answers are on the way on Take Two. They keep things loose, they keep things alive. Every border was dancing in the moonlight. Dancing in the moonlight. Everybody's feeling warm and bright. It's such a fine and natural sight. Everybody's dancing in the moonlight. We like our phone and we... Oh, sooky, sooky.
So that we can live happily.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming at kpcc.org. I'm John Raby sitting in today for A. Martinez. The movie theater business got a huge blow today when Warner Brothers pulled its plans to release Tenet, the new Christopher Nolan movie, next month. And in TV, well, I'm starting to wonder if we're going to revert to watching older and older content because new shows may not be able to get made. For industry news, every Monday we turn to John Horn and his new podcast, Hollywood, The Sequel. Hi, John.
Hey, John.
Before we get to the pod, what in the world made Warner Brothers think it would be able to release Tenet in theaters?
Well, I think if you think back a couple of months, everybody thought that maybe things would be settled down by June and then maybe they'd be settled down by July. And you go back and look at the release calendar, Warner Brothers, like Disney with its film Mulan, keeps moving the release date. It's now very clear that theaters are not going to be able to be open in August. Some people say they're not going to be open this year. And Warner Brothers has this $200 million movie that's gathering dust. It's unclear if they're going to open the film overseas first and then bring it to the States. It's unclear if it's going to play in theaters at all domestically. A lot is up in the air.
Also, doesn't some of it rely on Christopher Nolan himself, who's famously one of the only directors who insists on shooting on film, not digital? He's a diehard movie theater advocate. Would he okay the release of Tenet on a streaming device or something?
I can't imagine that he would okay it. But if it's you only can watch it that way or not at all, he might come around. The idea that somebody might watch Tenet on a laptop or, God knows, a mobile phone is probably horrific to Christopher Nolan, because not only does he really believe in film as a medium, he also is kind of not a tech guy. He famously didn't have a cell phone for years. I don't know if he even has one now, but he believes in the old-fashioned way of shooting and seeing a movie. And he even has shot a lot of his films in wide format like IMAX. So he believes you should be in a big auditorium watching a huge screen, because his cinematography is generally excellent, and that's the way that movies should be seen. But again, we're living in a very new world right now, and if Warner Brothers and Christopher Nolan want this movie seen by American audiences within the next, I would say, 6 months, theaters are not an option, I don't think.
Okay, John Horn, let's get to the new episode of Hollywood, The Sequel, your podcast. Who's your guest this week?
It is Gloria Calderon-Kellett. She is the co-showrunner of a remake of a show that maybe you remember from your youth, One Day at a Time.
Yep.
It was on, I think, opposite McMillan and Wife and maybe Mission Impossible. Who knows? It is a updated version of the Norman Lear comedy, but it's a lot more political. It's about a Cuban-American family in Los Angeles and Echo Park. And whereas the old show, which I think you remember, starred Bonnie Franklin, Mackenzie Phillips, and Valerie Bertinelli, was about like dating and clothes, this is about mental illness, immigration, homophobia, gender identity, Latinos. I mean, it's much more political than its predecessor.
What are her biggest concerns about the impact of the virus on the TV business?
Well, I guess there's a couple. One is, like, what is it going to take to actually shoot a show anymore? And what is that going to look like? How can you bring actors back? How does that mean that people will be safe? What kind of precautions are you going to have in place? And I think that's, a concern that a lot of people have. And she's also concerned, like, there are places and shows that might not survive this. There could be costume shops, there could be prop houses, there could be series that aren't gonna make it.
All of us creators can't help but think, does COVID kill our show, right? Like, does it end a lot of shows that are, making their way and trying to get by and can't survive this time or this much time off?
Do you think that's a real possibility? Because nobody has really expressed that there's gonna be different kinds of shows, but that shows on the bubble may not make it at all.
Absolutely. I mean, I've seen it already. I've seen great shows already get canceled that I think would have had a shot had COVID not happened, for sure.
And John, are you hearing this from other people in TV too?
Starting to. I mean, the real issue now is because production keeps getting delayed and delayed and delayed, what are those shows going to look like? Because as you mentioned at the top, at a certain point, we're going to run out of new content and we're going to watch the old episodes of One Day at a Time and McMillan and Wife, because at a certain point, it's probably middle of next year. If production is shut down, there are not going to be new shows, and it's just going to be reruns. So what new shows will people green light? What are those kinds of shows? Are they going to be from newcomers and new voices, or are they going to be traditional stories? And I think that's a real concern now. Will Hollywood kind of reset and go back to something that's much more cautious and careful and predictable than doing something that's risky?
Does she think that One Day at a Time is going to survive?
Well, it already has moved networks. It was on Netflix for its first three seasons, and it was canceled by Netflix. There was a big hue and cry from fans and critics, and it went on at Pop TV. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a real problem. If there's not enough audience for any show, it's not going to survive. And one of the other issues that a lot of people have is, like, how are you getting marketing now? If there's so much money being spent by Netflix on promoting its new seasons, if you're on a smaller streaming channel, how do you rise above all the noise? Because there's so much out there. How do you get noticed and how do you attract an audience? And more important, retain it when you go off the air for a while.
We're talking with John Horn, who is the host of the brand new podcast, Hollywood the Sequel. He joins us every Monday here on Take Two to talk about the week's episode. Gloria's show is one of the only ones run by a Latina that has a majority Latino cast. She is also an advocate for getting more Latino people in film and TV. What did she tell you is happening on that front?
Well, she makes the case, first of all, that it's a good economic decision. If you are trying to make content that is for the country, it should look like the country. And the more you diversify the people who are creating the content behind the scenes and then acting in it, the better off you're going to be because the country can see itself reflected in those stories. And she tells a very personal story about watching I Love Lucy growing up, and Ricky Ricardo meant something to her.
Yeah.
Because it said that there is a person who sounds like me who has a place in television. And she said, if you look at TV now or more recently, there are not very many Latinos. And the Latinos that are on TV tend to be criminals or gang members or something like that. So not only is it not really appealing to the audience, but it's also reinforcing a very negative stereotype.
We haven't told the story of the people of color being the best. There is this story that the people of color need to be represented, but they're not going to be as good, and it's a huge favor. That's the story that's sort of out there. The story needs to change, which is this is going to make your show better. Having these people is going to make your show better.
Not only is it an impassioned argument, John, but it's also incredibly logical. So what's getting in the way?
Because nobody wants to follow what is so clearly simple. And that what that means, if you're going to do that, is that the white people in power have to get out of the way and admit their own shortcomings. So I think what she's really saying also in the interview is people need to challenge their own thinking. And she said that a lot of people that she knows have taken time during the pandemic to really look at themselves. And what she says, I'm going to quote her now, everyone is embarking on some sort of reckoning with themselves. We are also going through this racial reckoning and this reckoning as a country about what works and what doesn't work. And so she thinks that if people really in Hollywood, obviously and elsewhere, start looking hard at themselves and really recognize their own shortcomings, their own biases, then maybe they can start hiring people who are going to do a better job and reflect the stories that need to be told.
Speaking of, on Friday, Congressman John Lewis died at the age of 80, a civil rights icon, the conscience of the Congress. And 3 years ago, you interviewed him where?
It's a little bit embarrassing to say Comic-Con International in San Diego.
That's
which
cool.
Is the big fan convention where, you know, it's tens of thousand people. John Lewis was there to promote his graphic novel series called March. It is a phenomenal series of graphic novels about the civil rights movement. In fact, he says in the interview that he did with us about how the drama of a graphic novel can be more important than just printed words in a history book.
I believe in this format, you're able to make it real, make it simple. You can see us sitting down at lunch counter stools, people spitting on us, pouring hot water on us, hot coffee. And we're so orderly and so peaceful, then we get arrested and go to jail. It tells stories that are powerful. Just a group of young people, college students, coming together, believing in the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence, as a way of life, as a way of living.
And to see him on the floor of the convention of Comic-Con, you know, there's people dressed as Transformers and Spider-Man and Batman and who knows what else. And he's wearing the backpack and the jacket that he wore when he marched in Selma. And he's doing a kids' march. And all these kids are following behind him. And you would say to yourself, what story is more important? The story that John Lewis is telling or the story of the Transformers?
And gee, John, I wonder where all those kids who were at Comic-Con wound up, say, like a month ago.
Let's hope they were out marching. Yeah. Let's hope they were part of the Black Lives Matter movement. Let's hope that they read what John Lewis said and said, if he can do it, I can do it. He's an inspiration, and I want to follow in his footsteps.
John, I'm a little jealous of A. Martinez that he gets to have this much fun talking with you every week.
Thank you.
John Horn, the host of the new Elias Studios podcast, Hollywood the Sequel. The latest episode has an interview with Gloria Calderon-Kellett, co-creator of One Day at a Time. The podcast comes out tomorrow. You just got a sneak peek. You can get it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. Well, it's time to wrap up take two, but if you want some more John Lewis, we got Marketplace coming up in just a couple minutes, but after that, on The Daily, a look at the extraordinary life of the civil rights icon John Lewis. That's at 3:30. Then looking ahead, tonight at 8 o'clock, you know, Terry Gross has this amazing back catalog of interviews, and of course, she spoke with Congressman John Lewis, so you're going to hear him in his own words tonight at 8 o'clock. Fresh Air with Terry Gross here on 89.3 KPCC. Some other cool stuff coming up at 3 o'clock on Marketplace, talking about tipping. Is that done? And on All Things Considered, warm weather typically brings a surge in crime, but during the pandemic, it's a lot more different, a lot more nuanced. So that's all coming your way, including All Things Considered with Nick Roman at 4 o'clock. As you just keep listening all day long to 89.3 KPCC, maybe on the KPCC app, maybe streaming at kpcc.org. Maybe you tell your robot friend, hey, play KPCC. However you do it, thank you so much for being with us, for spending your time with us, for trusting us with your ears. For everybody here at Take Two, I'm John Raby. A. Martinez is coming back sometime, but we have a whole list of great guest stars coming up this week on Take Two, including Austin Cross. So stay tuned. Coming up on 3 o'clock.